As you say, it would seem to me that most of the regulators have chosen violence, judging from such remarks as I heard on my way here. Perhaps, husband said reluctantly. Yet they, are not an avenging army, not a mob. And yet his unwilling glance toward the window suggested his awareness that a mob was indeed what was forming on the banks of the Alamance. Do they have a chosen leader? Anyone who can speak officially for them? Roger interrupted again, impatient to deliver his message and be gone. Yourself, or perhaps Mr. Hunter? Husband paused for a long moment, wiping the back of his hand across his mouth as though to expunge some lingering rancid taste. He shook his head. They have no real leader, he said softly. Jim Hunter is bold enough, but he has no gift of commanding men. I asked him. He said that each man must act for himself. You've the gift. You can lead them. Husband looked scandalized, as though Roger had accused him of a talent for card sharping. Not I. You've led them here. They have come here. I asked none to. You are here. They followed you. Husband flinched slightly at this, his lips compressed. Seeing that his words had some effect, Roger pressed his case. You spoke for them before, and they listened. They came with you, after you. They'll still listen, surely. He could hear the noise outside the cabin growing. The crowd was impatient. If it wasn't yet a mob, it was damn close. And what would they do if they knew who he was and what he had come to do? His palms were sweating. He pressed them down across the fabric of his coat, feeling the small lump of his militia badge in his pocket, and wished he had paused to bury it somewhere when he crossed the creek. Husband looked at him a moment, then reached out and seized him by both hands. "Pray with me, friend," he said quietly. "Thee need say nothing," husband said. "I know thee is papist, but it is not our way to pray aloud. If thee would but remain still with me and ask in your heart that wisdom be granted, not only to me, but to all here." Roger bit his tongue to keep from correcting husband. His own religious affiliation was scarcely important at the moment, though evidently husband's was. Instead, he nodded, suppressing his impatience, and squeezed the older man's hands, offering what support he might. Husband stood quite still, his head slightly lowered. A fist hammered on the flimsy door of the cabin, voices calling out, "Herman, you all right in there?" "Come on, Herman, there's no time for this. Cordwall's come back from the governor." "An hour, Herman, he's given us an hour, no more." A trickle of sweat ran down Roger's back between his shoulder blades, but he ignored the tickle, unable to reach it. He glanced from husband's weathered fingers to his face, and found the other man's eyes seemingly fixed on his own, and yet distant, as though he listened to some far-off voice, disregarding the urgent shouts that came through the walls. Even husband's eyes were Quaker grey, Roger thought, like pools of rainwater shivering into stillness after a storm. Surely they would break down the door. But no. The blows diminished to an impatient knocking, and then to random thumps. He could feel the beating of his own heart slowing gradually to a quiet, even throb in his chest, anxiety fading in his blood. He closed his own eyes, trying to fix his thoughts, to do as husband asked. He groped in his mind for some suitable prayer, but nothing save confused fragments of the Book of Common Worship came to hand. "Help us, O Lord. Hear us." "Help us, O Lord," his father's voice whispered. His other father, the Reverend, speaking somewhere in the back of his mind.
"Help us, O Lord, to remember how often men do wrong through want of thought, rather than from lack of love, and how cunning are the snares that trip our feet."
Each word flickered briefly in his mind like a burning leaf rising from a bonfire's wind, and then disappearing away into ash before he could grasp it. He gave it up then, and simply stood, clasping husband's hands in his own, listening to the man's breathing, a slow, rasping note.
"Please," he thought silently,
though with no idea what he was asking for. That word, too, evaporated, leaving nothing in its place. Nothing happened. The voices still called outside, but they seemed of no more importance now than the calling of birds. The air in the room was still, but cool and lively, as though a draught played somewhere in the corners, not touching them where they stood in the centre of the floor. Roger felt his own breath ease, his heart slow its beat still more. He didn't remember opening his eyes, and yet they were open. Husband's soft grey eyes had flecks of blue in them and tiny splinters of black. His lashes were thick, and there was a small swelling at the base of one, a healing sty. The tiny dome was smooth and red, fading from a ruby dot at the centre through such successions of crimson, pink and rose-red as might have graced the dawn sky on the day of creation. The face before him was sculpted with lines that drew rough arcs from nose to mouth, that curved above the heavy, grizzled brows whose every hair was long and arched with the grace of a bird's wing. The lips were broad and smooth, a dusky rose. The white edge of a tooth glistened, strangely hard by contrast with the pliable flesh that sheltered it. Roger stood without moving, wondering at the beauty of what he saw. The notion of husband as a stocky man of middle age and indeterminate feature had no meaning. What he saw now was a heartbreaking singularity, a thing unique and wonderful, irreplaceable. It struck him that this was the same feeling with which he had studied his infant son, marvelling at the perfection of each small toe, the curve of cheek and ear that squeezed his heart, the radiance of the newborn skin that let the innocence within shine through. And here was the same creation. No longer new, perhaps. Less innocent, but no less marvellous. He looked down and saw his own hands then, still gripping husband's smaller ones. A sense of awe came on him with the realization of the beauty of his own fingers, the curving bones of wrist and knuckle, the ravishing loveliness of a thin red scar that ran across the joint of his thumb. Husband's breath left him in a deep sigh, and he pulled his hands away. Roger felt momentarily bereft, but then felt the peace of the room settle upon him once more. The astonishment of beauty succeeded by a sense of deep calm.
"I thank thee, friend Roger," husband said softly. "I had not hoped to receive such grace, but it is welcome."
Roger nodded, wordless. He watched as husband took down his coat and put it on, his face settled now in lines of calm determination. Without hesitation, the Quaker lifted the bolt from the door and pushed it open. The crowd of men outside fell back, the surprise on their faces giving way at once to eagerness and irritation. Husband ignored the storm of questions and exhortations and walked directly to a horse that stood tethered to a sapling behind the cabin. He untied it and swung up into the saddle and only then looked down into the faces of his fellow regulators.
"Go home," he said in a loud voice. "We must leave this place. Each man must return to his own home."
This announcement was met with a moment of stunned silence, and then by cries of puzzlement and outrage.
"What home?" called a young man with a scraggly ginger beard. "Maybe you've got a home to go to. I ain't."
Husband sat solid in his saddle, unmoved by the outcry.
"Go home," he shouted again. "I exhort you. Nothing but violence remains to be done here." "Aye, and we'll bloody do it," bellowed one thick-set man, thrusting his musket overhead to a ragged chorus of cheers.
Roger had followed husband and was largely ignored by the regulators. He stood at a little distance, watching as the Quaker began slowly to ride away, bending down from his saddle as he did so, to shout and gesture to the men who ran and shoved beside him. One man grabbed husband by the sleeve, and the Quaker drew up his rein, leaning down to listen to what was obviously an impassioned speech. At the end of it, though, he straightened up, shaking his head, and clapped his hat on.
"I cannot stay and let blood be shed by my staying. If thee remain here, friends, there will be murder done. Leave, thee can still go. I pray thee do so."
He was no longer shouting, but the noise around him had ceased long enough for his words to carry. He raised a face creased with worry and saw Roger standing in the shadow of a dogwood. The stillness of peace had left him, but Roger saw that the look of determination was still there in his eyes.
"I am going," he called. "I beg thee all, go home."
He reined his horse around with sudden decision and kicked it into a trot. A few men ran after him, but soon stopped. They turned back, looking puzzled and resentful, muttering in small groups and shaking their heads in confusion. The noise was rising again as everyone talked at once, arguing, insisting, denying. Roger turned away, walking quietly toward the cover of the maple grove. It seemed wiser to be gone as soon as possible now that husband had departed. A hand seized him by the shoulder and spun him round.
"Who the hell are you? What did you say to Herman to make him go?"
A grimy fellow in a ragged leather vest confronted him, fists clenched. The man looked angry, ready to take out his frustrations on the nearest available object.
"I told him that the governor doesn't want anyone to be harmed if it can be avoided," Roger said, in what he hoped was a calming tone.
"Do you come from the governor?"
a black-bearded man asked sceptically, eyeing Roger's grubby homespun.
"Do you come to offer different terms than Caldwell has?"
"No."
Roger had been still under the effects of the meeting with husband, feeling sheltered from the currents of anger and incipient hysteria that swirled about the cabin. But the peace of it was fading fast. Others were coming to join his interrogators, attracted by the sound of confrontation.
"No," he said again, louder. "I came to warn husband, to warn all of you. The governor wants..."
He was interrupted by a chorus of rude shouts, indicating that what Tryon wanted was a matter of no concern to those present. He glanced around the circle of cliff.
"Do you come to offer different terms than Caldwell has?"
"No."
Roger had been still under the effects of the meeting with husband, feeling sheltered from the currents of anger and incipient hysteria that swirled about the cabin. But the peace of it was fading fast. Others were coming to join his interrogators, attracted by the sound of confrontation.
"No," he said again, louder. "I came to warn husband, to warn all of you. The governor wants..."
He was interrupted by a chorus of rude shouts, indicating that what Tryon wanted was a matter of no concern to those present. He glanced around the circle of faces, but saw none that offered any expression of forbearance, let alone friendliness. He shrugged then, and stepped back.
"You'll suit yourselves then," he said,
as coolly as possible.
Mr. Husband gave you his best advice. I second it."
He turned to leave, but was gripped by a pair of hands that descended on his shoulders, pulling him forcibly around to face the ring of questioners once more.
"Not so fast, Chuck,"
said the man in the leather vest. He was still flushed with angry excitement, but his fists were no longer clenched.
"You've spoke with Tryon, have you?"
"No," Roger admitted. "I was sent..."
He hesitated. Ought he to use Jamie Fraser's name?
No, better not. It was as likely to cause trouble as to save him,
but somehow muffled, as though someone else were speaking, some distance away. I've not seen the governor myself, but I have heard his stated purpose. He does not wish to see bloodshed, but he is determined to take such actions as he perceives necessary to disperse this assembly. Yet, if you will return peaceably to your homes, he is disposed to leniency. A moment of silence greeted this, to be broken by a hawking noise. A glob of mucus, streaked brown with tobacco juice, landed with a splat in the mud near Roger's boot.
"That," observed the spitter concisely, "for the governor's leniency." "And that for you, fuckwit," said one of his companions, swinging an open palm toward Roger's face.
He ducked the blow, and lowering his shoulder, charged the man, who staggered off balance and gave way. There were more beyond him, though. Roger stopped, fists balled, ready to defend himself if need be.
"Don't hurt him, boys," called the man in the leather vest. "Not yet, anyways."
He sidled round Roger, keeping well out of range of his fists, and eyed him warily.
"Whether you've seen Tryon's face or not, reckon you've seen his troops, haven't you?"
"I have." Roger's heart was beating fast, and the blood sang in his temples, but oddly enough, he wasn't afraid. The crowd was hostile, but not bloodthirsty. Not yet.
"So how many men does Tryon have?"
The man was watching him closely with a glint in his eye. Best to answer honestly. The odds were good that the answer was already known. There was nothing whatever to hinder men of the regulation from crossing the Alamance and assessing the situation for themselves. "A few more than 1,000, Roger said, watching the man's face carefully. No surprise. He had known. "But they are trained militia," Roger added pointedly, with a glance at a number of the regulators who, having lost interest in Roger, had resumed a wrestling match nearby. "And they have artillery. I think you have none, sir." The man's face closed like a fist.
"Think what you like," he said shortly. "But you can tell Tryon that we boast twice his number. And be we trained or not," his mouth twisted ironically, "we are all armed, each man with his musket."
He tilted back his head, squinting against the light.
"An hour, is it?" he asked more softly. "Sooner than that, I think."
He lowered his gaze, looking Roger in the eye.
"Go you back across the creek, then, sir. Tell Governor Tryon that we mean to have our say and have our way of it. If he will listen and do as we demand, well and good. If not..."
He touched the hilt of the pistol in his belt and nodded once, his face settling into grim lines. Roger glanced around at the circle of silent faces. Some bore looks of uncertainty, but most were sullen or openly defiant. He turned without a word and walked away, the reverend's words whispering among the spring leaves as he passed beneath the trees.
"Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God."
He hoped one got credit for trying. Chapter 63. The Surgeon's Book 1.
Item number 28. The surgeons to keep a book and enter each man that comes under his care, namely the man's name, the company he belongs to, the day he comes under his hands, and the day he discharges him. Camp duties and regulations.
I felt a cool breeze touch my cheek and shivered, though the day was very warm. I had the sudden absurd thought that it was the glancing touch of a wing feather, as though the angel of death had silently passed by me, intent on his dark business.
"Nonsense," I said aloud.
Evan Lindsay heard me. I saw his head turn momentarily, but then turn back. Like all the others, he kept glancing toward the east. People who don't believe in telepathy have never set foot on a battlefield, nor served with an army. Something passes unseen from man to man when an army is about to move. The air itself is live with feeling. Half dread, half eagerness, It dances over the skin and bores the length of the spine with an urgency like sudden lust. No messenger had come yet, but one would. I knew it. Something had happened somewhere. Everyone stood rooted, waiting. I felt an overwhelming urge to move, to break that spell, and turned abruptly, my hands flexing with the need to stir, to do something. The kettle had boiled. The water sat ready, covered with a piece of clean linen. I had set up my medicine chest on a stump. I put back the lid and began to go mindlessly through its contents yet again, though I knew all was in order. I touched the gleaming bottles one by one, their names a soothing litany. Atropine, belladonna, laudanum, paregoric, oil of lavender, oil of juniper, pennyroyal, lady's vetch, and the squat brown glass bottle of alcohol. Always alcohol. I had a keg of it, still on the wagon. Movement caught my eye. It was Jamie. The sun sparking through the leaves on his hair as he moved quietly under the trees, bending here to speak a word in someone's ear, touching there a shoulder, like a magician bringing statues to life. I stood still, hands twisted in the folds of my apron, not wanting to distract him, yet wanting very much to attract his attention. He moved easily, joking, touching casually, and yet I could see the tension in him. When had he last stood with an army, waiting the order to charge? At Culloden, I thought, and the hairs rippled erect on my forearms, pale in the spring sun. Hoofbeats sounded nearby and the crushing sound of horses moving through brush. Everyone swung round in expectation, muskets held loose in their hands. There was a general gasp and murmur as the first rider came into view, ducking her bright red head beneath the maple boughs. "Holy Christ," Jamie said, loudly enough to be heard across the clearing. "What in hell is she doing here?" There was a ripple of laughter from the men who knew her, fracturing the tension like cracks in ice. Jamie's shoulders relaxed very slightly, but his face was rather grim as he strode to meet her. By the time Brianna had pulled up her horse and swung down from her saddle next to him, I had reached them too. "What?" I began. But Jamie was already nose to nose with his daughter, his hand on her arm, eyes narrowed and speaking in a rapid torrent of low-voiced Gaelic. "I'm that sorry, Mum, but she would come." A second horse ambled out of the trees, an apologetic-looking young black man on top. It was Joshua, Jocasta's groom. "I couldn't have prevented her, nor could Mrs. Sherston. We did try." "So I see," I said. Brianna's colour had risen in response to whatever Jamie was saying to her, but she showed no sign of getting back on her horse and leaving. She said something to him, also in Gaelic, that I didn't catch, and he reared back as though stung on the nose by a wasp. She nodded sharply, once, as though satisfied with the impact of her statement, and turned on her heel. Then she saw me, and a wide smile transformed her face. "Mama!" She embraced me, her gown smelling faintly of fresh soap, beeswax, and turpentine. There was a small streak of cobalt blue paint on her jaw. "Hello, darling! Wherever did you come from?" I kissed her cheek and stood back, cheered by the sight of her in spite of everything. She was dressed very plainly in the rough brown homespun she wore on the ridge, but the clothes were fresh and clean. Her long red hair was tied back in a plait, and a broad straw hat hung from its strings down her back. "Hillsborough," she said. "Someone who came to dinner at the Sherstons last night told us that the militia was camped here, so I came. I brought some food." She waved at the bulging saddlebags on her horse. "And some herbs from the Sherstons' garden I thought you might use."
Oh, yes. Lovely."
I was uneasily aware of Jamie's glowering presence somewhere behind me, but didn't look around.
I don't mean to sound as though I'm not pleased to see you, darling, but there is just possibly going to be a fight here before too long, and..."
"I know that."
Her colour was still high, and it deepened somewhat at this. She raised her voice slightly.
"That's all right. I didn't come to fight.
If I had, I would have worn my breeches. She darted a glance over my shoulder, and I heard a loud snort from that direction, followed by guffaws from the Lindsay brothers. She lowered her head to hide a grin, and I couldn't help smiling too. "I'll stay with you," she said, lowering her voice as well and touching my arm. "If there's nursing to be done afterward, I can help." I hesitated, but there was no question that if things did come to a fight, there would be wounded to treat, and an extra pair of hands would be useful. Brianna wasn't skilled at nursing, but she did understand about germs and antisepsis, knowledge of much more value in its way than a grasp of anatomy or physiology. Bree had straightened. Her glance flickered over the men who waited in the maple shade, searching.
"Where's Roger?"
she asked, her voice low but level. "He's all right," I assured her, hoping it was true. "Jamie sent him across the creek this morning with a flag of truce to bring back Herman's husband to talk with the governor."
"He's over there?"
Her voice rose involuntarily, and she lowered it, self-conscious.
"With the enemy?
If that's the right word for them."
"He'll be back."
Jamie stood by my elbow, viewing his daughter with no great favour, but obviously resigned to her presence.
"Dinna fash, lassie. No one will trouble him under a flag of truce."
Bree raised her head, looking as far as she could into the distance toward the creek. Her face had drawn in upon itself, a pale knot of apprehension.
"Will a flag of truce help him if he's still over there when the shooting starts?"
The answer to that, which she obviously knew, was probably not. So did Jamie, who didn't bother saying it. He also didn't bother saying that perhaps it wouldn't come to shooting. The air was thick with anticipation, acrid with the scent of spilled black powder and nervous sweat.
"He'll be back,"
Jamie repeated, though in a gentler tone. He touched her face, smoothing back a random lock of hair.
"I promise, lass. He'll be all right."
The look of apprehension faded a bit as she searched his face. She seemed to find some reassurance there, for a little of the tension left her, and she nodded in mute acceptance. Jamie leaned forward and kissed her on the forehead, then turned away to speak to Rob Burns. Bree stood looking after him for a moment, then untied the strings of her bonnet, and came to sit down beside me on a rock. Her hands were trembling slightly. She took a deep breath and clasped her knees to still them.
"Is there anything I can do to help now?"
she asked, with a nod toward my open medicine box. "Do you need me to fetch anything?" I shook my head.
"No, I have everything I need.
There isn't anything to do but wait." I grimaced slightly. "That's the hardest part." She made a small sound of reluctant agreement and relaxed with a visible effort. She assessed the waiting equipment, a slight frown between her brows, the fire, the boiling water, the folding table, the large instrument box, and the smaller pack that held my emergency kit.
"What's in there?" she asked,
poking a boot-shod toe at the canvas sack.
"Alcohol and bandages, a scalpel, forceps, amputation saw, tourniquets. They'll bring the wounded here if they can, or to one of the other surgeons. But if I have to go to a man wounded on the field, someone too bad to walk or be carried, I can snatch that up and go at once."
I heard her swallow, and when I glanced up at her, the freckles stood out on the bridge of her nose. She nodded and drew a deep breath to speak. Her face changed suddenly, though, switching comically from seriousness to repugnance. She sniffed once, suspiciously, her long nose wrinkling like an anteater's. I could smell it too, the stink of fresh feces coming from the grove directly behind us.
"That's rather common before a battle," I said, low-voiced, trying not to laugh at her expression. "They're caught short, poor things."
She cleared her throat and didn't say anything, but I saw her gaze roam round the clearing, resting now on one man, then another. I knew what she was thinking. How was it possible? How could one look at such an orderly, compact bundle as a man, head bent to catch a friend's words, arm stretched to take a canteen, face moving from smile to frown, eyes lighted and muscles taut, and envision rupture, abrasion, fracture, and death? It couldn't be done. It was an act of the imagination that lay beyond the capability of one who hadn't ever seen that particular obscene transformation. It could, however, be remembered. I coughed and leaned forward, hoping to distract us both. "Whatever did you say to your father?" I asked out of the side of my mouth. "When you came, when you were speaking Gaelic." "Oh, that." A slight flush of amusement momentarily relieved her paleness. He was snarling at me, wanting to know what I thought I was playing at. "Did I mean to leave my child an orphan?" he said, "risking my life along with Rogers." She wiped a strand of red hair away from her mouth and gave me a small edgy smile. So I said to him, "If it was so dangerous, where did he get off risking making me an orphan by having you here, I laughed, though keeping that, too, under my breath. "It's not dangerous for you, is it?" she asked, surveying the militia encampment. "Back here, I mean." I shook my head. "No. If the fighting comes anywhere close, we'll move right away. But I don't think..." I was interrupted by the sound of a horse coming fast, and was on my feet, along with the rest of the camp, by the time the messenger appeared. One of Tryon's baby-faced aides, pale with bottled-up excitement. "Stand ready," he said, hanging out of his saddle, half-breathless. "And what do you think we've been doing since dawn?" Jamie demanded, impatient. "What in God's name is happening, man?" Very little, apparently, but that little was important enough. A minister from the regulator's side had come to parley with the governor. "A minister?" Jamie interrupted. "A Quaker, do you mean?" "I do not know, sir," said the aide, annoyed at being interrupted. "Quakers have no clergy. Anyone knows as much. No, it was a minister named Caldwell, the Reverend David Caldwell."
This ends Disc 28. The Fiery Cross, Disc 29.
Regardless of religious affiliation, Tryon had been unmoved by the ambassador's appeal. He could not, would not deal with a mob, and there was an end to it. Let the regulators disperse, and he would promise to consider any just complaints laid before him in a proper manner. But disperse they must within an hour.
"Could you, would you, in a box?" I murmured under my breath, half unhinged by the waiting. "Could you, would you, with a fox?"
Jamie had taken off his hat, and the sun shone bright on his ruddy hair. Bree gave a strangled giggle, as much shock as amusement.
"He could not, would not, with a mob," she murmured back. "Could not, would not, do the job." "He can, though," I said, sotto voce, "and I'm very much afraid he will."
For the 100th time that morning, I glanced toward the scrim of willows through which Roger had disappeared on his errand.
"An hour," Jamie repeated, in answer to the aide's message.
He glanced in the same direction toward the creek.
"And how much time is left of that?"
"Perhaps half an hour."
The aide looked suddenly much younger even than his years. He swallowed and put on his hat.
"I must go, sir. Listen for the cannon, sir. And luck to you."
"And with you, sir."
Jamie touched the aide's arm in farewell, then slapped the horse's rump with his hat, sending it off. As though it had been a signal, the camp sprang into a flurry of activity, even before the governor's aide had disappeared through the trees. Weapons already primed and loaded were checked and rechecked, buckles unfastened and refastened, badges polished, hats beaten free of dust, and cockades affixed, stockings pulled up and tightly gartered, filled canteens shaken for reassurance that their contents hadn't evaporated in the last quarter hour. It was catching. I found myself running my fingers over the rows of glass bottles in my chest yet again, the names murmuring and blurring in my mind like the words of someone telling rosary beads, sense lost in the fervour of petition. Rosemary, atropine, lavender, oil of cloves. Bree was notable for her stillness among all this bustle. She sat on her rock with no movement save the stir of a random breeze in her skirts, her eyes fixed on the distant trees. I heard her say something under her breath and turned. "What did you say?" "It's not in the books." She didn't take her eyes off the trees, and her hands were knotted in her lap, squeezing together as though she could will Roger to appear through the willows. She lifted her chin, gesturing toward the field, the trees, the men around us. "This," she said, "it's not in the history books. I read about the Boston Massacre. I saw it there, in the history books, and I saw it here in the newspaper. But I never saw this there. I never read a word about Governor Tryon or North Carolina or a place called Alamance. So nothing's going to happen." She spoke fiercely, willing it. "If there was a big battle here, someone would have written something about it. Nobody did, so nothing's going to happen. Nothing." "I hope you're right," I said, and felt a small warming of the chill in the small of my back. Perhaps she was. Surely it couldn't be a major battle, at least. We were no more than 4 years from the outbreak of the Revolution. Even the minor skirmishes preceding that conflict were well known. The Boston Massacre had happened a little more than a year before. A street fight, a clash between a mob and a platoon of nervous soldiers, shouted insults, a few stones thrown, an unauthorized shot, a panicked volley, and 5 men dead. It had been reported with a good deal of fierce editorializing in one of the Boston newspapers. I had seen it in Jocasta's parlor. One of her friends had sent her a copy. And 200 years later, that brief incident was immortalized in children's textbooks, evidence of the rise in disaffection of the colonists. I glanced at the men who stood around us, preparing to fight. Surely, if there was to be a major battle here, a royal governor putting down what was essentially a taxpayers' rebellion, that would have been worth noting. Still, that was theory, and I was uneasily aware that neither warfare nor history took much account of what should happen. Jamie was standing by Gideon, whom he had tethered to a tree. He would go into battle with his men on foot. He was taking his pistols from the saddlebag, putting away the extra ammunition in the pouch at his belt. His head was bent, absorbed in the details of what he was doing. I felt a sudden, dreadful urgency. I must touch him, must say something. I tried to tell myself that Bree was right. This was nothing. Likely not even a shot would be fired. And yet there were 3,000 armed men here on the banks of the Alamance, and the knowledge of bloodshed hummed and buzzed among them. I left Brianna sitting on her rock, burning eyes fixed on the wood, and hurried to him. "Jamie," I said, and put a hand on his arm. It was like touching a high-voltage wire. Power hummed inside the insulation of his flesh, ready to erupt in a burst of crackling light. "They say one can't let go of such a line. A victim of electrocution simply freezes to the wire, helpless to move or save himself as the current burns through brain and heart." He put his hand on mine, looking down.
"Anian Dun," he said, and smiled a little. "Have you come to wish me luck, then?"
I smiled back as best I could, though the current sizzled through me, stiffening the muscles of my face as it burned. "I couldn't let you go without saying something. I suppose good luck will do." I hesitated, words jamming in my throat with a sudden urge to say much more than there was time for. In the end, I said only the important things. "Jamie, I love you. Be careful." He didn't remember Culloden, he said. I wondered suddenly whether that loss of memory extended to the hours just before the battle, when he and I had said farewell. Then I looked into his eyes and knew it did not.
"Good luck will do," he said,
and his hand tightened on mine, likewise frozen to the current that surged between us.
"I love you," does much better.
He touched my hand, lifted his own, and touched my hair, my face, looking into my eyes as though to capture my image in this moment, just in case it should be his last glimpse of me.
"There may come a day when you and I shall part again," he said softly at last,
and his fingers brushed my lips, light as the touch of a falling leaf. He smiled faintly.
"But it will not be today."
The notes of a bugle came through the trees, far away, but piercing as a woodpecker's call. I turned, looking. Brianna sat still as a statue on her rock, looking toward the wood. Chapter 64. Signal for Action.
Note, when on the march, the discharge of 3 pieces of cannon will be the signal to form the line of battle, and 5, the signal for action. Order of battle, William Tryon. Roger walked slowly away from the regulator's camp, willing himself neither to run nor to look back. A few shouted insults and half-meant threats were hurled in his direction, but by the time he was well into the trees, the crowd had lost interest in him, drawn back into its buzzing controversy. It was past noon, and a hot day for May, but he found his shirt sweat-soaked and clinging to him in a manner more befitting July. He stopped as soon as he was out of sight. He was breathing fast and felt dizzy, slightly sick with the after-effects of adrenaline. In the centre of that ring of hostile faces, he hadn't felt a thing, not a thing. Safely away, though, the muscles of his legs were trembling and his fists ached from clenching. He uncurled them, flexed his stiff fingers, and tried to slow his breathing. Maybe a bit more like the nighttime channel and the anti-aircraft guns than he'd thought, after all. He'd made it back, though, would be going home to his wife and son. The thought gave him a queer pang, bone-deep relief, and an even deeper grief, quite unexpected, for his father, who hadn't been so lucky. A slight breeze played about him, lifting the damp hairs on his neck with a breath of welcome coolness. He'd sweated through shirt and coat together, and his damp stock felt suddenly as though it would strangle him. He shucked his coat and pawed the neckband, jerking it off with shaking fingers, then stood with his eyes closed and the piece of cloth dangling from his hand, breathing great draughts of air until the momentary sense of nausea subsided. He called to mind his last sight of Brianna, framed in the doorway, Jemmy in her arms. He saw her lashes wet with tears, and the baby's round, solemn eyes, and felt a deep echo of the feeling he had experienced in the cabin with husband. A vision of beauty, a conviction of joy that soothed his mind and eased his soul. He would go back to them. That was all that mattered. After a moment, he opened his eyes, picked up his coat, and set off, beginning to feel more settled in body, if not in mind, as he made his way slowly back toward the creek. He hadn't brought back husband to Jamie, but he had achieved as much as Jamie himself might have. It was possible that the mob—they were no army, whatever Tryon thought of them—would in fact fall apart, disperse now, and go home, deprived of even the faint semblance of leadership husband had provided. He hoped so. Or they might not. Another man might rise out of that seething mob, one fit to take command. A thought struck him, with a phrase recalled from the confusion near the cabin.
"Do you come to offer different terms than Caldwell has?"
The man with the black beard had asked him that. And earlier, dimly heard through the pounding at the door of the cabin as he stood in prayer with husband,
"There's no time for this," someone had shouted. "Caldwell's come back from the governor." And someone else had added, in tones of desperation, "An hour, Herman, He's given us an hour, no more. Shit, he said aloud.
David Caldwell, the Presbyterian minister who had married him and Bree.
It must be.
Evidently the man had gone to speak with Tryon on the regulator's behalf, and been rebuffed with a warning.
An hour, no more.
An hour to disperse, to leave peaceably, or an hour to reply to some ultimatum. He glanced up. The sun stood overhead, just a bit past noon. He pulled on his coat and stuffed the discarded stock in his pocket, next to the unused flag of truce. Whatever it meant, that hour's grace, it was clearly time to be going. The day was still bright and hot, the smell of grass and tree leaves pungent with rising sap. Now, though, his sense of urgency and his memory of the regulators buzzing like hornets deprived him of any appreciation of the beauties of nature. Even so, some trace of peace remained deep within him as he made his way quickly toward the creek, a faint echo of what he had felt in the cabin. That odd sense of awe had stayed with him, hidden but accessible, like a smooth stone in his pocket. He turned it over in his mind as he made his way toward the creek, largely oblivious to clutching brambles and brush in his path. How peculiar, he thought. Nothing whatever had happened. And in fact, the entire experience had felt quite ordinary. Nothing otherworldly or supernatural about it. And yet, having seen by that particular clear light, he couldn't forget it. Could he explain it to Brianna, he wondered. A trailing branch brushed past his face, and he reached to push it aside, feeling, even as he did so, a faint surprise at the cool green gloss of the leaves, the odd delicacy of their edges, jagged as knives but paper light. An echo, faint but recognisable, of what he had seen before, that piercing beauty. Did Claire see that? He thought suddenly. Did she see the touch of beauty in the bodies beneath her hands? Was that perhaps how, and why, she was a healer? Husband had seen it too, he knew, had shared that perception. And seeing it had been confirmed in his Quaker principles, and had left the field, unable either to do violence or to countenance it. And what of his own principles? He supposed they were unchanged. If he hadn't meant to shoot anyone before, he could mean it still less now. The scents of spring still hung in the air, and a small blue butterfly floated past his knee with no apparent sense of care. It was still a fine spring day, but all illusion of tranquillity had vanished. The smell of sweat, of dirt and fear and anger that seemed to hang in the air of the encampment was still in his nostrils, mingling with the cleaner scents of trillium and water. "What about Jamie Fraser's principles?" he wondered, turning past the thicket of willow that marked the ford. He often wondered what made Fraser tick, drawn both by a personal liking for the man and by his colder historian's curiosity. Roger had made his own decision regarding this conflict, or had it made for him? He couldn't in conscience intend harm to anyone, though he supposed he could defend his own life if needful. But Jamie... He was fairly sure that Jamie's sympathies, as such, lay with the regulators. He thought it likely also that his father-in-law had no sense of personal loyalty to the crown. Oath or no oath, surely no man could have lived through Culloden and its aftermath and emerged with any notion that he owed the King of England fealty, let alone anything more substantial. No, not to the crown, but perhaps to William Tryon. No loyalty of a personal nature there, either. But there was definitely an obligation felt. Tryon had summoned Jamie Fraser, and he had come. Given conditions as they stood, he had had little choice about that. Having come, though, would he fight? How could he not? He must lead his men, and if it came to a battle... Roger glanced over his shoulder as though the cloud of anger that hung over the Regulator's army might now be visible... swelling dark above the treetops. Yes, he would have to fight, no matter what his private feelings on the matter might be. Roger tried to envision himself aiming a musket at a man with whom he had no quarrel and pulling the trigger. Or worse, riding down a neighbour, sword in hand. Smashing in Kenny Lindsay's head, for instance. Imagination failed completely. No wonder that Jamie had sought to enlist husband's help in ending the conflict before it began. Still, Claire had told him once that Jamie had fought in France as a mercenary, as a young man. He had presumably killed men with whom he had no quarrel. How... He pushed through the willows and heard their voices before he saw them. A group of women were working on the far side of the stream, camp followers. Some crouched bare-legged in the shallows, washing. Others were carrying wet laundry up the bank to be hung from trees and bushes. His eye passed casually beyond them, then jerked back, caught by... What? What was it? There. He couldn't say why he had spotted her at all. There was nothing even faintly distinctive about her. And yet she stood out among the other women as though she had been outlined, drawn with black ink, to stand out against the backdrop of stream and budding foliage. Morag, he whispered, and his heart thumped suddenly with a small shock of joy. She was alive. He was halfway through the screen of willows before it occurred to him to wonder what he was doing, let alone why he was doing it. It was too late by then, though. He was already out on the bank, walking openly toward them. Several of the women glanced at him. A few half froze, watchful. But he was only one man, unarmed. There were more than 20 women by the river, their own men nearby. They watched him, but not alarmed, as he splashed across the shallow creek. Curious. She stood stock still, knee-deep in the water, her skirts curtled high, and watched him come. She knew him, he could see, but she gave him no sign of acknowledgement. The other women fell back slightly, wary of him. She stood among the darting dragonflies, strands of brown hair poking out from her cap, a wet smock held forgotten in her hands. He stepped up out of the water and stood before her, wet to the knees.
"Mrs. Mackenzie," he said softly. "Well met."
A tiny smile touched the corner of her mouth. Her eyes were brown. He hadn't noticed that before.
"Mr. Mackenzie," she said,
and gave him a small nod.
His mind was working, thinking what to do. He must warn her, but how? Not before all the other women.
He stood helpless and awkward for a moment, not knowing what to do. Then, inspired, he stooped and seized an armload of dripping laundry where it swirled in the water near her legs. He turned and clambered up the bank with it, Morag following in sudden haste.
"What are you doing?" she demanded. "Here, come back with my clothes."
He carried the wad of wet clothes a short way into the trees, then dropped them casually into a bush, mindful enough of the effort of washing not to let them drag in the dirt. Morag was right behind him, face flushed with indignation.
"What do you think you're about, you thieving clothied?" she demanded heatedly. "Give those back."
"I'm not stealing them," Roger assured her. "I only wanted to talk to you alone for a bit."
"Why?"
she gave him a suspicious glance.
"What about then?"
He smiled at her. She was still thin, he saw, but her arms were brown and her small face a healthy colour. She was clean, and she had lost the pallid, bruised look she had had on board the Gloriana.
"I wish to ask if you were well," he said softly. "And your child, Jimmy."
To speak the name gave him an odd frisson, and for a split second he saw the image of Brianna in the doorway, her son in her arms, laid over his memory of Morag, holding her baby in the dimness of the hold, ready to kill or die to keep him.
"Oh," she said,
and the suspicion faded slightly, replaced by a reluctant acknowledgement of his right to ask.
"We're well, the both of us. And my husband, too," she added pointedly.
"I'm pleased to hear it," he assured her, "very pleased."
He groped for something else to say, feeling awkward.
I had thought of you now and then. Wondered whether everything was all right. When I saw you just now, well, I thought I'd ask, that's all.
Oh, aye. Aye, I see. Well, I do thank you, Mr. Mackenzie.
She looked up and met his eyes directly as she said it, her own gaze brown and earnest.
I ken what you did for us. I'll not forget. You're in my prayers each night.
Oh.
Roger felt as though some soft weight had struck him in the breast.
Thank you.
He had wondered now and then if she ever thought of him. Did she remember the kiss he had given her, there in the hold, seeking the spark of her warmth as some shield against the chill of loneliness? He cleared his throat, flushing at the memory.
You live nearby?
She shook her head, and some thought, some memory, tightened her mouth.
We did.
But no. Well, that's no matter.
She turned, suddenly businesslike, and began to take her wet clothes from the bush, shaking each one before folding it.
I do thank you for your concern, Mr. Mackenzie.
He was clearly dismissed. He wiped his hands down his breeks and shifted his feet, not wanting to leave.
He must tell her.
But having found her again, he was oddly reluctant simply to warn her and leave. Curiosity bubbled in him. Curiosity, and a peculiar sense of connection.
Perhaps not so peculiar. This small brown woman was his relative. His own family. The only person of his own blood he had known since the death of his parents. At the same time, it was very peculiar, he realized, even as his hand reached out and curved around her arm. She was his many times great-grandmother, after all.
She stiffened, tried to pull away, but he kept hold of her forearm. Her skin was cold from the water, but he felt her pulse throb under his fingers.
Wait, he said, please. Just a moment. I need to tell you things.
No, you don't. I'd rather you didn't.
She pulled harder, and her hand slid through his, pulled free.
Your husband? Where is he?
Belated realizations were forming in his brain. If she didn't live nearby, then she was what he had first thought when he saw the women, a camp follower.
She wasn't a whore. He would stake his life on that.
So she followed her husband, which meant,
he is very nearby.
She backed up a step, eyeing the distance between herself and the remnants of her laundry. Roger stood between her and the bush. She would have to pass near him in order to retrieve her petticoats and stockings. Realizing suddenly that she was slightly afraid of him, he turned hastily, grabbing a handful of things at random.
I'm sorry. Your laundry. Here.
He thrust them at her, and she reached to take them by reflex. Something fell, a baby's gown, and both ducked to reach for it, cracking foreheads with a solid smack.
Oh! Oh, Mary and Bride!
Morag clutched her head, though she still clasped the wet clothes against her bosom with one hand.
Christ, are you all right? Morag, Mrs. Mackenzie, are you all right? I'm very sorry.
Roger touched her shoulder, squinting at her through eyes that watered with pain. He stooped to pick up the tiny gown that had fallen to the ground between them, and made a vain effort to wipe the smears of mud off the wet cloth. She blinked, eyes similarly watering, and laughed at his expression of dismay. The collision had somehow broken the tension between them. She stepped back, but seemed not to feel threatened now.
I am fine.
She sniffed and wiped her eyes, then touched the spot on her forehead gingerly.
I've got a thick skull, my mam always said. Are you all right yourself, then?
Aye, fine.
Roger touched his own forehead, suddenly and tinglingly aware that the curve of the brow bone under his fingers was precisely echoed on the face before him. Hers was smaller, lighter, but just the same.
I've a thick skull, too,
He grinned at her, feeling ridiculously happy.
It runs in my family.
He handed her the mud-stained shirt carefully.
I am sorry, he said,
apologizing again, and not only for the ruined laundry.
Your husband,